Most parishes celebrate First Communion during the Easter season, and that was our plan here, but we had to change because of the closure to the public. And in any case, Corpus Christi makes a great time to celebrate this feast, so I think it's working out nicely. We've got two great people here in the front, enormously handsome today to celebrate it with. They're both wonderful people. They're very enthusiastic, thoughtful. These two are also very affectionate. For several years now, both have been very vigorous in giving me a hug when Mass is over. And sometimes it's a surprise attack. I don't even see it coming. They just kind of weave their way through a crowd. So I thank you for that. They have great families who are here with them too. You probably recognize these two a little bit. I could tell you just a little anecdote about each of them to kind of suggest their character a little bit. One is about Eli. Last August, I think it was, his grandmother was telling me that when he started religious education, he had gone for the first day, and she asked him, what did he learn the first day? There's a lot to learn about being Catholic, so it's just one day. I mean, where do you begin? It's not easy. So she asked him, and he said immediately to her, "Don't eat the apple." Apparently, conversation about Adam and Eve, I guess, but what a good one-sentence summary of the moral life. Don't eat the apple. So I thought that was a great answer. So here's a story about Theo. And his parents already know this story. It's one of my favorites from my time here. It still cracks me up. So it was one Sunday night. I was greeting people right outside, and Theo comes down full of energy. You may remember this. And he gives me a big hug, and I said to him, "Theo, are you going to go to seminary one day and become Father Theo?" And he said immediately, this was just before he had started school, he said, "No, Father, I'm going to kindergarten." Do you remember that? That's a good place to start, kindergarten. It was a good, wise career choice. One of the things I want to talk about today with regard to these two is their names. They have magnificent names, Elijah and Theodore. Your families did a great job giving you these names, and they have enormously deep and profound meanings. So I want to say a couple words about their names, and then I want to offer two little thoughts on current unrest and turmoil in the city and in the world. So start with Elijah. Elijah in Hebrew means "the Lord is God." Really a beautiful name. It's an incredible sentiment, "the Lord is God." In a way, it seems like it may be a little redundant. The Lord is God, okay? It's obvious, self-evident. But there's something much deeper that's at work in this name, Elijah, "the Lord is God." One of the revolutionary aspects of the Hebrew scriptures is that it traces the development from polytheism, belief in many gods, or henotheism, belief in one God amongst many possible deities, local deities to believe in, towards monotheism, belief in the one true God. Monotheism turns everything upside down when it comes to worship, to honoring the one true God. Oftentimes in polytheism, when there are many gods, the gods resemble us in the whims and caprices, the weaknesses, the folly of humanity. They're almost made in our image and likeness. But monotheism turns us upside down. In monotheism, at best, we resemble God. God is so wholly other and transcendent that if we're made in God's image and likeness, we strive to be like God. It's not the case that God is trying to be like us. It changes everything. One of the beauties, then, is that the name of Elijah identifies the one true God. The Lord is God. And it speaks then to the real temptation of idolatry, to have false gods that are before the one true God. Sometimes we think that idolatry was a temptation in the biblical world that we've outgrown. But the reality is, idolatry is still very much with humanity in our day. We have a constant temptation to place false gods, lowercase g, before the one true God. We haven't outgrown the first commandment. And Elijah, this name, is kind of like a cry of faith. The Lord is God. It places ourselves in right relation to the one true God. So it's an important name for each of us, something that we should cling to in a way, because when we realize it, the Lord is God, It changes our lives. We become changed men and women. Here's a place in the Gospels where this happens. In John chapter 20, the disciples have already encountered the risen Lord, except for St. Thomas. It's a famous moment. And when Thomas places the finger in the wounds of Christ, he says, "My Lord and my God!" Exclamation mark. And Thomas is never the same. He's a changed person from that moment on. Of all the disciples, none go farther in Thomas in proclaiming the good news. He's a changed man. And that's the invitation for us as well. It's not something that we can take for granted that the Lord is God. It has to be for us a cry of faith, something that we enter into and affirm for ourselves in recognizing the one true God. This was a great name. So Theodore is a great name too. In Greek, Theodore means gift from God, which is a wonderful way to think about somebody coming into the world. Before your parents even knew you, they thought of you as a gift from God from the very beginning. Amazing. And it should be like that for every human life. And that expression, gift from God, helps us to understand the meaning of the Eucharist. The gospel today comes from John chapter 6. It's a very long chapter that's called the Bread of Life Discourse. The Lord speaks of the Eucharist as body and blood at length in this chapter, in a teaching that is very challenging in many ways. There's a part in this sixth chapter of John's gospel where many people who have been following Jesus leave. So at one point, Jesus turns to the disciples and he says, "Are you also going to leave?" And then Peter, to his everlasting credit, says in that moment, "Lord, where can we go? You have the words of everlasting life." Beautiful. Where can we go, Lord? You have the words of everlasting life. We see in John 6 that the Lord has very detailed thoughts about the Eucharist and what it means. Most things that we eat, all of them, in fact, become us. They become part of our constitution. They nourish the mind, the body, the spirit. But the Eucharist is the food that's different, because when we consume the Eucharist, we become more like what we're taking into ourselves. We become transfigured, transformed, fashioned to be more like Christ himself. It's why it's food that's so important for us, this great gift from God that God gives to sustain us. We become like the Eucharist in receiving it because Christ is truly present there. Body, blood, soul, and divinity. He's in the Eucharist. And in a way, the Eucharist for us is an invitation. Because if Christ is truly present there, the invitation to each of us is that we offer God our real presence, our true presence, when we encounter him in this worship. It's not easy because as human beings, we get distracted in life every minute in one way or another. But when we give God our true presence, not just in worship and church, but in the world, in our daily lives, it's the highest form of worship that we're capable of, and it unites us more deeply to God. So great names, Theodore, Elijah. Here's two little thoughts on our day. One image that's come to mind for me is something I came across probably a decade ago. I was vacationing with family. We were out in Colorado, and we were doing this horseback ride, and this gentleman was giving us kind of a tour, and we went through this grove of aspens. And the guy stopped and he was explaining a little bit about aspens. I'd never given any thought to this particular tree before, but he said, "You can make an argument that aspens are the largest organism in the world. When you went through this grove of trees, it looked like they're all separate trees, but he said beneath the surface, their root system is deeply, intimately intertwined so that they're all essentially one organism in this general area." It's kind of a fascinating thought. And an enormously rich and profound symbol. And I think it's one we can and should borrow for humanity. 7 billion people on the planet, and on the surface of life, it can look like we're independent structures, people, kind of going our own way haphazardly. But as Christians, we're obligated to acknowledge that we are people beneath the surface too. And if we get beneath the surface of life, all of us are deeply interconnected, interwoven into one for one reason. we're made in the image and likeness of God. It's the common denominator of all humanity. And it's something that we dismiss and overlook to our great peril. Mother Teresa had a great way of framing this in one sentence. She said, "If we have no peace, it is simply because we have forgotten that we belong to one another." That's an amazing way to frame the woes of our day. If we have no peace, it is simply because we have forgotten that we belong to one another. It's a great insight. We begin in life, in a sense, we gravitate towards the people that we're related to, towards close friends. That's a great beginning in life, but it's not far enough. We have to go further to acknowledge that with every person we do encounter or could encounter, there's a deep and fundamental connection that gives us a deep kinship with every human being on the face of the planet, and that we're a human being, that we're made in the image and likeness of God. It's a revolutionary realization, and it's an important one, I think, in our day to acknowledge that we experience this. Here's a second thought. It comes from a saint. I came across this line a few years ago. I don't remember who the saint is. I've packed up a lot of my books, and I think I could have found it, but I don't have access to that book and the lives of the saints. But this particular saint was remembered for being famously patient with other people, which is would make one a saint, because that's a very difficult thing to do. So it turns out that this saint had a line that he would use anytime someone attacked him or cursed him or upset him, said something mean-spirited to him, annoyed him. He had a line that he would go to, kind of in his pocket, which is brilliant. Because what gets us in trouble is, for most of us, we don't have that line handy, and what we say is something that we regret. We get defensive, we lash out. It's a common human temptation. So just the fact that he had this line ready is a great insight. But what the line is enormously helpful. Anytime somebody would slander him, say something mean-spirited, curse him, he would say, "I pray that God may make of you a saint. I pray that God may make of you a saint." That's a great beginning for interacting with other people. We know that in our day we have overwhelming number of reasons to disagree and be mean-spirited towards other people, one another. That's a great place to begin. I pray that God may make of you a saint. It's a way of acknowledging that we're not there yet. We haven't been made saints by God's grace yet, but we're striving for it. And if we will that for other people, it gives us a great foundation for honoring the dignity of one another. We begin by praying that others might become saints, especially people that we disagree with. But we go from there towards, importantly, helping others to become saints. It's good to pray, and that's the beginning. But life for us should be an expression of how we can help other people to become saints. We owe them that much for the good of the world, and we owe it to God at the same time, too.